Today is Northwest Crossings LLC versus Bruce Lavalour PC. Mr. Brower, good morning to you. Not quite yet. Ms. Hansen, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before we begin? Then, Mr. Brower, you may approach the podium and you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Sig Brower. I represent Bruce Lavalour, PC, defendant. Guarantee Group was a business that was involved in building, constructing homes, various types of construction projects in the city of Grand Island at the time this occurred. And they were involved in developing a fairly large housing project that involved 205 houses at least the aspect that's at issue here. Mr. Lavalour was a CPA who had from time to time done some work with Guarantee Group and some related companies. In 2014, Guarantee Group undertook a project under what was referred to commonly as TIF, tax increment financing, to develop this housing project. After getting into the project, its principal, Mr. Sean O'Connor, came to the appellant, Mr. Lavalour, with concerns that this development was going to lose a substantial amount of money. The numbers are not very clear, but it could have been in the area of $1,700,000. He asked Mr. Lavalour to look at the numbers and see if he could determine what the problem may be. Mr. Lavalour was engaged in a practice which involved a lot of tax returns, and this was during a tax return period. He didn't have much time at that point to do it, but he did eventually go into evaluation of the concerns that Mr. O'Connor raised. At the end of that investigation, he came to Mr. O'Connor and he says, I think you're...
Did the parties reach an oral contract as to what the terms of his engagement would be before he set out to do this work?
No, and I think that's a significant issue because there was no actual contract going into the process. There was some discussion about compensation if Mr. Lavalour was capable of finding a response or resolution to the concerns.
But your position is there was not a contract before he began the work?
There was no specific contract with the terms of what was to be done and what the compensation was to be.
They did agree work was going to be done and there would be compensation for the work.
There was a discussion to the effect that if Mr. Lavalour was able to reach a productive resolution, that there would be discussion at that point about what the compensation would be.
What was the testimony about $800 an hour?
There was discussion at one point that may be a value that Mr. Lavalour would place on it because of a prior involvement he had in another action in some activity for another person. But there was never an actual agreement to that effect, as I believe the evidence discloses. There was discussion that would be addressed after and if Mr. Lavalour came to a favorable resolution of the concerns that Mr. O'Connor had.
So was an agreement ever reached?
I'm sorry?
Was there an agreement ever reached for compensation?
There was an agreement reached, and in fact, I think it's interesting that the district court finding states specifically that there was an agreement. On page 302 of the record, the court in its address from the bench states that there was an agreement to provide, in the fall of 2013, there was an agreement to provide a home to Bruce LaValier, and that the agreement was not in writing, that in June of 2014, there was an agreement for Mr. LaValier based upon services that he had performed at that time to be able to obtain $1,000 per house for the closing of 205 houses paid toward the construction loan, and then have cash on hand once that had been paid off with the guaranteed group.
So I want to...
Do you think there were two contracts? Do you think there were two oral contracts?
I don't think there were two contracts. I think what the record demonstrates is that there were negotiations about what this contract should look like. There were, initially there was an agreement, or there was a proposal that since Mr. O'Connor did not have liquidity to make a substantial payment, Bruce suggested that he build the house and just give him the house. The record reflects that Mr. O'Connor said his company did not have the liquid assets to do that, and then it was proposed that $1,000 be taken from the closing on each of the 205,000.
I want to nail down something and make sure I understand.
Yes.
Is your position that the evidence shows there's an initial discussion about doing some work, but no contract is reached, Mr. LaValier performs the work, and then after the work is performed, the parties reach a contract for the compensation?
I believe that's the record. I believe that's what it demonstrates.
Can a contract be formed when the consideration has already been provided? Is that
sure.
a valid contract?
Sure. You can have an agreement that involves prior consideration that supports an agreement. I believe that's clear in the law. So yes, I think that is true.
That's what your position is, that the contract is here. A contract for consideration that's already been provided.
Yes, I think it's prior consideration that supports the agreement that was reached to define what the compensation was going to be. The prior consideration being Mr. LaValier's services. One of the things that I know this court has addressed many times, and that is you can't enter an agreement, an enforceable agreement, to make an agreement. You're not supposed to be able to do that. But in this case, they discussed it. And after it was all said and done, the parties got together and they did reach an agreement in which the prior consideration supplied by Mr. LaValier was used to support the responsive consideration by Guaranteed Group to provide a home.
So we've spent a lot of your time on the nature of the agreement, but opposing counsel, I suspect, is going to argue that the directed verdict in this case was appropriate, both because the contract was unenforceable under the statute of frauds and because it was void as against public policy because there was no disclosure made to the guarantee group in writing as to the terms of a contingent fee. Would you like to address
Certainly.
Either one of those?
Absolutely. The court found there was an agreement. The court found the agreement was not enforceable because it was not in writing. This court has repeatedly, numerous times, and in the very words, consistently enforced agreements that, but for performance by one party within a year, would not be unenforceable. So where there's performance on one side within that year, the court has said they consistently take it out of the statute and enforce the agreement.
Are you taking the position that your client's performance under the contract that was ultimately reached was completed before the contract was ultimately formed?
Yes, it was. Before any final decision was made as to the compensation to be paid for it. That performance was done, the recommendations were made to O'Connor, and they were implemented by O'Connor. And after that, they reached an agreement as to what the compensation would be. I think what's important...
Wasn't the compensation to be apportioned every time a lot was sold, your client was to get $1,000, and could that have possibly been done within a year?
The agreement was, the evidence is that the agreement was that O'Connor or Guaranty Group would build a house that out of the 205 homes, $1,000 per closing would be taken out to be paid toward the loan to build that house. That was not by any terms of an agreement to take more than a year, but the evidence was that it was not likely to be accomplished within a year. I think that's significant because this court has specifically said that it is the terms of the contract that require it to be more than a year, not if it happens to take more than a year. But I'm not sure that we even get there, because the court has also consistently held that if one party performs within the year, it comes out of the statute. So the court, I think, erred when it found that this was, that the directed verdict was supported by the fact that the contract was not in writing, and that's contrary to this court's consistent ruling. And he also erred when he said that the real estate that was, may I finish my comment?
You may.
He also erred when he made a finding that because it involved a transfer of real estate, it was also subject to the statute, which in fact the appellee recognizes was not raised as an affirmative defense. But even that, the courts have held that it comes out of the statute, even in a real estate transfer, if one site is fully performed within the year.
Chief, can I ask one more question?
You may.
Your position with respect to Guaranty Group's argument that this contract was a contingent fee contract with no disclosure made in writing, I assume your position is this wasn't a contingent fee because there wasn't a contract until the work had already been performed. Do I have that right?
I think there are two facets to that. One is that, yes, there was no actual contingent fee, and if there was no fee agreement because the terms were not fully supplied. There wasn't a contingent fee. There was an expression of a contingency that if I find a way to fix your problem, we will sit down and negotiate a compensation package.
But your position is no contract at that time.
I think that's correct. And the other thing is, I don't think that even if one considered a contract, that the terms of that rule that has been raised, well, two things. I don't think the terms of that rule specifically apply to whatever contract is perceived. And secondly, it was not raised as an affirmative defense, and the court never addressed it and said that's why I'm finding this contract unenforceable. So I think for those reasons, it doesn't apply.
Let me go back to basics just to remind the court, what do you believe our standard of review is of the ruling to which you object?
Well, the ruling we object to is a finding that a verdict is directed based upon the fact that there was a failure to have a written agreement. This court, I think that's an issue of law. It's clearly an issue of law, so this court has to know what to do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hansen, you may approach the podium and you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, Mr. Brower, may it please the court. Both state statute and Nebraska case law have been abundantly clear as to what is required to have a binding contract. The district court below was correct in dismissing the plaintiff's or Lavalier's causes of action for the reason that there was no contract. And in this case,
They say there was no contract or that the contract was unenforceable under the statute of frauds?
He said the district court judge found that it would be a question for the jury as to whether or not there was a contract, but that there was no contract that was enforceable in this case for two reasons, the statute of frauds for 1 year and the statute of frauds for real estate. We believe that there are three independent reasons that the court could have or did find that there was no binding contract. First, no contract was formed, which I believe was admitted here today. Second, the rules of professional conduct for accountants would make this void as a matter of public policy. And third, this case falls squarely within the statute of frauds for 1 year, making it an unenforceable.
Let me interrupt just slightly. What is the strength of those rules of professional conduct?
I think
the hierarchy, constitution, statutes, and so forth.
The Nebraska legislature has given the Board of Accountancy the ability to promulgate laws, so it is a statute that controls, and therefore, if the legislature has determined that something is void as a matter of public policy, you cannot have a legally binding contract that the legislature has determined to be void. And in this case, the Nebraska Board of Public Accountancies has said that if there is a contingent fee agreement, and contingent fee is defined in two different ways. One, if it's contingent on getting a finding or result, or if the amount that is going to be paid is contingent on the result, then it shall be in writing.
What shall be in writing?
The contingent fee agreement shall
be. Is that what the rule says? Doesn't the rule refer to a written disclosure provided at the time payment is expected or accepted? That I don't read that to say that the agreement itself has to be in writing. Am I wrong on that?
I believe what it says is that it shall provide written disclosure of such acceptance or payment and the basis for determining the fee to such client. And I think this is analogous to the rules of public for professional conduct for attorneys. And our rule says a contingent fee agreement shall be in writing and signed by a client and shall state the method by which the fee is to be determined.
That sounds different to me. The lawyer rule says the agreement shall be in writing. The accountant rule says you shall make a written disclosure.
And I think the distinction there is for the accountants, it doesn't seem that it has to be signed by the client, whereas the rules for the attorneys have to be signed by the client.
Well, then it wouldn't be the agreement, right? If the client doesn't have to sign it in the accountant context, this is a disclosure that's separate than the agreement itself, or could be.
Well, I think that there has to be a written disclosure, and I think it's undisputed in this case that there was no written disclosure as to the basis for determining the fee to the client.
How do you respond to your opponent's argument that this public policy defense was not raised in the news?
The public policy defense was not stated in the answer that was filed in this case. However, it is fundamental that in order to prove a legally, that is incumbent upon the person who was saying that there was a contract to prove a legally valid contract. And in this case, there was not a legally valid agreement because it was void because there was no written disclosure. And so therefore, I don't believe that we had to plead it as an affirmative defense because the burden was always on them to prove a legally binding contract and they did not do so. I think in this case, there was no offer and acceptance. There was no meeting of the minds. And it's fundamental specifically to a service contract that you know both what the service is and what the terms of the payments are going to be.
I understood Mr. Brower today to say, and I don't know that I appreciated this from the party's briefs, but I understood his position today to be there was not a contract reached until after Mr. Lavaler performed the work at issue. Can a contract be formed based on consideration that's already been provided?
No, and I think what the court will find when they review the record in this case is that the timeline may not be as such as was presented to be today. Mr. Lavaler testified at the time of trial that the conversation about the $800 occurred in February 2014, and at the time the conversation about the $800 was made, he says, if I can find a solution for you, it's going to be $800. He said, also, if I do something that is not helpful to you, I will shake your hand and walk away. So that conversation.
Let's take his position as he's presented it, at least for now, which is no contract formed until after the work's already been provided. Can you form a binding and enforceable agreement based on consideration that's already been provided?
I don't believe that you can. And I don't believe his performance was also done in this case, as the record reflects. He continued to do work after that July conversation took place. Also, I still don't believe that we know what his role was going to be in this case. If you look at his testimony as to the scope of the work, as I said he was going to do something that was helpful or that he was going to do something that would provide a solution. We don't know what that is. So, for example, he testified that one of the first things that he came up with was to put the value of the lot on the closing statement, because the assessor looks at the value of the lot and determining the price, which then goes to the amount of the increment. And he said, in response to that, that Ray O'Connor and Sean O'Connor were literally dancing in his office. So was his fee earned then because he was helpful in some sort of projection? We still don't know that that was helpful. Then Ms. Pellin, who's the county assessor, said that that wasn't going to solve the problem. Mr. Lavalier agreed that that wasn't going to solve the problem. He then apparently comes up with a solution to have the lots not developed, so not putting in the infrastructure, and that would solve the problem. However, again, we still don't know if his fee was earned at that time. Because was it helpful? We don't know. The project was still ongoing. So
I beg your pardon, and this may be antithetical to your main thesis, but can you have two agreements between parties, and one is the nature of the work, and some modest consideration, right, and an amount of fees being a separate agreement?
I think
here's
it would
the work, scope of the work. One, scope of work, two, amount of fees.
I think in order to have a binding contract, there would have to be offer and acceptance, and you would have to know what the terms are, and there would have to be consideration for both of them. So I guess
respect to the first one in the hypothetical, what did we learn in law school with pepper talk? It's just nominal consideration.
And I guess I fail to see if the scope of the work, what the consideration would be, or how that would form a binding contract if he just says, I'm going to do something for you. I don't see what the mutuality in that contract would be. So I think that there has to be some sort of mutuality in the contract in order for there to be a binding contract. And I just don't know that they ever got there here. To me, it's kind of like the court looked up and tilt up concrete, that there were some ongoing negotiations that were taking place without the formation of the contract. And here, I just don't believe that there was ever a formation of the contract. So, for example, one of the projected losses that was testified to in this case was a $1.3 million projected loss. So let's say that Bruce Lavalier produced a spreadsheet that showed a $1 less loss. Would he have earned his fee at that time, or did he have to show a $1 profit? Did he have to simply provide an idea, or did the idea have to come to fruition? And if he found something that was a solution, I think you would have to have it fully come to fruition in order to determine whether or not it was helpful. Therefore,
what do we do, though, with there is evidence, is there not, albeit from Mr. Lavalier, but this is on a directed verdict, so we have to take this evidence or testimony in light most favorable to him, that at some point there's a conversation with Sean O'Connor and Mr. Lavalier says, how about $205,000? And he says Sean O'Connor agrees to this. I mean, there we have at least evidence of offer and acceptance, don't we?
I think there's two parts to consider. And although while the motion for directed verdict was against the Lavalier PC, an ever-controverted fact has to be in their favor, what this court has also said is that you cannot just look at the plaintiff's testimony in and of itself, and while that's usually in the context of part performance, I think it's applicable here, you have to look at the evidence. And what the conversations actually were about the $205,000, if you look at it in its totality, is that Mr. Lavalier came to Sean O'Connor and said, why don't you just give me the house that you were already building for me based upon the promise of Ray O'Connor. Sean O'Connor says, I can't do that because I don't have the cash liquidity. Then Mr. Lavalier says, why don't you take $1,000 out of each home or out of each closing cost and apply it to the lien? Then he says, what would happen after they're done taking the $1,000 out of each closing for the first 205 houses is that he and Mr. O'Connor would have another conversation to determine what the cash balance would be. And I think this court has been clear that if a party can just pick whatever its compensation is going to be without any sort of standard, it's an illusory contract. And I think that was in the Ackerley case.
Counsel, I think your argument is twisting the standard of review on directed verdict, which we have said the appellate court must treat the motion as an admission of the truth of all competent evidence submitted on behalf of the party against whom the motion is directed. And this argument about looking at it all in the totality, I don't think is quite faithful to that standard. Would you respond?
My time is up. May I please respond to the question?
You may.
While I think the key word there is competent evidence, and what this court has said in Fick versus Walton is to establish the part performance exception, the alleged acts of the performance must speak for themselves. Testimony by the plaintiff as to his or her intent in rendering the performance by itself is insufficient. And my position is that the evidence presented by Mr. Lavalier was insufficient to prove what they were trying to prove.
But my question wasn't about part performance. My question was about whether his testimony could establish, if believed, offer and acceptance.
And doesn't
Judge Castle's question about the directed verdict standard bear on that? Don't we have to, at least for purposes of a directed verdict, didn't the district court, and don't we, have to credit Mr. Lavalier's testimony?
May I continue to answer the question?
You may.
I don't know that it is competent evidence when you look at all of the evidence that's been presented. I don't think the standard is we have to believe everything that comes out of the person's mouth, because essentially then there would be no directed verdict if you have to believe everything that comes out of the person's mouth. If you look at the other evidence that's been presented...
Or we could wait and let the jury decide, right? I mean, that's what...
Yes, however...
The directed verdict isn't your only opportunity to win this case.
No, that's true. But this court has also said that you can't take something to the jury that would allow them, that would require them to engage in guess, speculation, or conjecture, that the court has a gatekeeping role to keep such out of the purview of the jury if the decision must be on guess, speculation, or conjecture. And I think the only thing the jury could have done in finding a contract was engage in guess, because as we stand up here now, we still don't know what the contract was.
Can you help me with a question on the record real quick? Is there anything in the record that shows that your client offered to pay some amount to settle this, to pay for these services?
I don't believe that there was any evidence of that, no. Mr. Lavalier testified that he did make that offer. However, Guarantee Group was present. We don't have a deceased defendant in this case. They could have called him to the stand. There was absolutely no documentary evidence of that provided. There was no invoices. There was no checks. So, for example, in...
Was there any statement that made by the plaintiffs in this case that there was some offer of $40,000 to pay off this amount?
There was testimony in this case. I believe that that conversation occurred in 2015. I apologize. I can't remember the exact year. That Ray O'Connor approached Mr. Lavalier and said, Ray and Sean O'Connor approached Mr. Lavalier and said, we just want to settle up with you. We will pay you $42,000 because you have done 42 closing statements, and we will pay you the $42,000 for the 42 closing statements that you made. Mr. Lavalier testified that he rejected that, both because he had not done 42 closing statements and that was not the agreement of the parties.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Brower, we'll give you a minute because we took a lot of time with Ms. Hansen.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the comment of the court is somewhat telling because the court says there was an agreement. The court describes the agreement. The court also makes a statement that if I didn't come to this conclusion, if this wasn't on a directed verdict, the question would be for the jury as to whether there is a contract. So the court took it, the court's taking it away on the directed verdict and finding that there was a contract, but the, basically the bottom line is the court said it's not enforceable because it's not in writing. And yet this court has repeatedly said these contracts come out of the statute if there is complete performance by one party within a year. And the testimony is that Mr. Lavalier did perform within a year, far less than a year, and it was after that that they entered into the discussion and negotiations for what the compensation for his services would be. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Counsel, that concludes arguments in Northwest Crossing LLC versus Bruce Lavalier PC. So you are excused, but you are free to remain for what will happen next, which will be a kind of question and answer session with students and others. So the court is officially adjourned at this point in time.